bacteria that live in your intestines and help with digestion are enhanced and nourished by probiotics. They play a role in producing, absorbing, and transporting neurochemicals such as serotonin, dopamine, and nerve growth factor, which are essential for healthy brain and nerve function. Understanding how this is possible requires a quick lesson in the science of your microflora-gut-brain communication. It's true that your gut is your second brain. This is an area of active, fascinating research, a large volume of which in recent years has demonstrated an intimate communication highway between the brain and the digestive system. Through this two-way connection, the brain receives information about what's going on in your intestines as the central nervous system sends information back to your gut to ensure optimal functioning. All this transmission back and forth makes it possible for us to control our eating behavior and digestion, and even find restful sleep at night. The gut also sends out hormonal signals that relay to the brain feelings of fullness, hunger, and even pain from intestinal inflammation. In diseases and illnesses that affect the intestines, such as uncontrolled celiac, IBS, or Crohn's disease, the gut can be a major influence on our well-being, how we feel, how well we sleep, what our energy level is, how much pain we experience, and even how we think. Researchers are currently looking at the possible role of some strains of intestinal bacteria in obesity, inflammatory and functional GI disorders, chronic pain, autism, and depression. They are also examining the role that these bacteria play in our emotions. So intricate and influential is this system that the health of our gut could be a much bigger player in our perception of overall health than we ever imagined. The information processed by the gut and sent up to the brain has everything to do with our sense of well-being. And if we can support this system just by consuming the gut's most important collaborators, healthy gut bacteria, then why not? Although lots of foods, such as yogurts and some beverages, are now fortified with probiotics, these products can often come with too much sugar. Ideally, get your probiotics through a supplement that offers a variety of strains, at least 10, including Lactobacillus acidophilus and Bifidobacterium, and contains at least 10 billion active bacteria per capsule. Coconut oil. As I've already described, coconut oil can help prevent and treat neurodegenerative disease states. It's a super fuel for the brain and also reduces inflammation. You can drink a teaspoon of it straight or use it when you prepare meals. Coconut oil is heat stable, so you can cook with it in high temperatures. In the recipe section, I'll give you some ideas for working with coconut oil in the kitchen. Alpha-lipoic acid. This fatty acid is found inside every cell in the body, where it's needed to produce the energy for the body's normal functions. It crosses the blood-brain barrier and acts as a powerful antioxidant in the brain in both watery and fatty tissues. Scientists are now investigating it as a potential treatment for strokes and other brain conditions involving free radical damage, such as dementia. Although the body can produce adequate supplies of this fatty acid, our modern lifestyles and inadequate diets often require supplementation. Vitamin D. It's a misnomer to call vitamin D a vitamin because it's actually a fat-soluble steroid hormone. Although most people associate it strictly with bone health and calcium levels, hence its addition to milk, vitamin D has far-reaching effects on the body and especially on the brain. We know there are receptors for vitamin D throughout the entire central nervous system. We also know that vitamin D helps regulate enzymes in the brain and cerebrospinal fluid that are involved in manufacturing neurotransmitters and stimulating nerve growth. Both animal and laboratory studies have indicated that vitamin D protects neurons from the damaging effects of free radicals and reduces inflammation. Let me state a few key findings. Reports have shown a 25% risk reduction in cognitive decline in individuals with higher levels of vitamin D. severely deficient individuals in one such study were 60% more likely to undergo cognitive decline over the 6-year follow-up. A study done over 7 years among 498 women showed that those with the highest intake of vitamin D had a 77% risk reduction for developing Alzheimer's disease. When the mental states of 858 adults were evaluated between 1998 and 2006, there was substantial decline in mental function in those individuals with severe vitamin D deficiency. Multiple studies link low levels of vitamin D with risk for Parkinson's and relapse in multiple sclerosis patients. As an aside, studies have shown that each 5 nanogram per milliliter increase in vitamin D levels in the blood correlates with a 16% reduction in relapses in MS. Low vitamin D levels have long been shown in medical literature to contribute to depression and even chronic fatigue. Adequate vitamin D is needed by the adrenal glands to help regulate an enzyme necessary for the production of dopamine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, critical brain hormones that play a role in mood, stress management, and energy. People with mild to severe depression have been known to experience turnarounds and improvements through supplementation alone. Correcting insufficient levels of vitamin D can take several months of supplementation, but doing so will significantly improve your entire body's chemistry, from bone health to brain health, and even its insulin sensitivity. My dietary protocol will also provide good sources of natural vitamin D found in nature, such as cold water fish and mushrooms. Chapter 8. Genetic Medicine. Jog your genes to build a better brain. Old minds are like old horses. You must exercise them if you wish to keep them in working order. John Adams. Pop quiz. What's going to make you smarter and less prone to brain diseases? Is it A, solving a complex brain teaser, or B, taking a walk? If you guessed A, I won't come down hard on you, but I will encourage you to go for a walk first, as fast as you can, and then sit down to work on a brainy puzzle. The answer, it turns out, is B. The simple act of moving your body will do more for your brain than any riddle, math equation, mystery book, or even thinking itself. Exercise has numerous pro-health effects on the body, especially on the brain. It's a powerful player in the world of epigenetics. Put simply, when you exercise, you literally exercise your genetic makeup. Aerobic exercise not only turns on genes linked to longevity, but also targets the gene that codes for BDNF, the brain's growth hormone. Aerobic exercise has been shown to reverse memory decline in the elderly and increase growth of new brain cells in the brain's memory center. For a long time now, we've known that exercise is good for the brain, but only in the past decade have we really been able to quantify and qualify the extraordinary relationship between physical fitness and mental fitness. It has taken the collective force of many inquisitive researchers working from different camps, including neuroscientists, physiologists, bioengineers, psychologists, anthropologists, and doctors from various other fields of medicine. It has also taken the development of many advanced technologies for us to be able to analyze and understand the inner workings of brain matter itself, including its individual neurons. The newest findings make it undeniably clear that the link between exercise and brain health isn't just a relationship. In the words of science writer Gretchen Reynolds for the New York Times, it is the relationship. Exercise, according to the latest science, appears to build a brain that resists physical shrinkage and enhances cognitive flexibility. And this, my friends, may mean that there is no greater tool at our fingertips than physical movement. Take a look at the two graphics in the accompanying PDF, one showing the percentage difference in one's risk for Alzheimer's disease based on level of exercise, and another showing the difference based on intensity of exercise. I think these are quite telling. The magic of movement. As humans, we have always been physically active until only quite recently. Modern technology has afforded us the privilege of a sedentary existence. Virtually anything we need these days is available without having to exert much effort, much less get out of bed. But our genome, over millions of years, evolved in a state of constant challenge, from a physical perspective, in our quest to find food. In fact, our genome expects frequent exercise. It requires regular aerobic exercise to sustain life. But unfortunately, too few of us respect that requirement today, and we have the chronic illness and high mortality rates to show for it. The idea that exercise can make us smarter has intrigued not just traditional researchers in biomedical labs, but also anthropologists searching for clues to the shaping of humankind through millennia. In 2004, the journal Nature published an article by evolutionary biologists Daniel E. Lieberman of Harvard and Dennis M. Bramble of the University of Utah, who argue that we survived this long in history by virtue of our athletic prowess. It was our cavemen ancestors who were able to outpace predators and hunt down valuable prey for food that allowed for survival, producing meals and energy for mating. And those early endurance athletes passed on their genes. It's a beautiful hypothesis. We are designed to be athletes so that we can live long enough to procreate. Which is to say that natural selection drove early humans to evolve into supremely agile beings, developing longer legs, stubbier toes, and intricate inner ears to help us maintain better balance and coordination while standing and walking on just 2 feet as opposed to 4. For a long time, science couldn't explain why our brains had gotten so big, disproportionately so when you consider our body's size in comparison to other animals. Evolutionary scientists in the past liked to talk about our carnivore behaviors and need for social interaction, both of which demanded complicated thinking patterns, to hunt and kill, and to engage in relationships with others. But now, science has another ingredient to add to the mix. Physical activity. According to the latest research, we owe our tremendous brains to the need to think and the need to run. To arrive at this conclusion, anthropologists examined patterns between the brain size and endurance capacity of many animals, from guinea pigs and mice to wolves and sheep. They noted that the species with the highest innate endurance capacity also had the highest brain volumes relative to their body size. Then, the researchers took their experiment further by looking at mice and rats that were intentionally bred to be marathon runners. They created a line of lab animals that excelled at running by interbreeding those that ran the most in their cages' wheels. And then, the truth began to emerge. Levels of BDNF and other substances that promote tissue growth and health began to increase in these newly bred animals. BDNF is also known to drive brain growth, which is why the new thinking is that physical activity may have helped us to evolve into clever, quick-witted beings. David A. Raiklin, an anthropologist at the University of Arizona and leading scientist in the evolution of the human brain, summed up the concept brilliantly in his explanation to the New York Times, as reported and paraphrased by Gretchen Reynolds. The more athletic and active survived, and as with the lab mice, passed along physiological characteristics that improved their endurance, including elevated levels of BDNF. Eventually, these early athletes had enough BDNF coursing through their bodies that some could migrate from the muscles to the brain, where it nudged the growth of brain tissue. With an enhanced ability to think, reason, and plan, early humans could then sharpen the skills that they needed to survive, such as hunting and killing prey. They benefited from a positive feedback loop. Being in motion made them smarter, and sharper minds further allowed them to stay in motion and move more effectively. Over time, humans would come to engage in complex thinking and invent things like math, microscopes, and MacBooks. The bottom line is that if physical activity helped us develop the brains we use today, then it's safe to say we need exercise to maintain those brains, not to mention to continue to evolve into a smarter, faster, more clever species. Be nimble and quick. The biology of how exercise can be so beneficial to brain health goes far beyond the argument that it promotes blood flow to the brain and thus delivers nutrients for cell growth and maintenance. Indeed, cerebral blood flow is a good thing. But that's old news. The latest science behind the magic of movement in protecting and preserving brain function is stunning. It boils down to five benefits: controlling inflammation, increasing insulin sensitivity, influencing better blood sugar control, expanding the size of the memory center, and, as I've already mentioned, boosting levels of BDNF. Some of the most compelling science has been performed in just the last couple of years. In 2011, Dr. Justin S. Rhodes and his team at the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology at the University of Illinois made discoveries using four groups of mice in four different living arrangements. One group lived in the lap of luxury in a setting that included lavish, mice-friendly meals, nuts, fruits and cheeses, and flavored waters, and lots of playful toys to explore, such as mirrors, balls, and tunnels. The second group of mice had access to the same treats and toys, but their living quarters included running wheels. A third group's cages resembled a Motel 6. It contained nothing extraordinary, and the mice ate standard kibble. The fourth group of mice similarly lacked access to fancy amenities and food, but their home included running wheels. At the start of the study, the mice underwent a series of cognitive tests and were injected with a substance that allowed the researchers to track changes in their brain structures. Over the next several months, the scientists let the mice do whatever they wanted in their respective homes, after which the researchers retested the mice's cognitive functions and examined their brain tissues. The one variable that clearly stood out above all others was whether or not the mice had a running wheel. It didn't matter if they had things to play with in their cages. The animals that exercised were the ones who had healthier brains and outperformed on the cognitive tests. Those that didn't run, even if their world was otherwise stimulating, didn't improve cognitively. The researchers were specifically looking for cognitive improvements that implied a boost in complex thinking and problem solving. Only exercise proved key to that improvement. We know that exercise spurs the generation of new brain cells. Scientists have actually measured this effect by comparing mice and rats that ran for a few weeks versus those that were sedentary. The running animals had about twice as many new neurons in their hippocampi as the couch potatoes. Other studies have looked at which types of exercise are the most effective. In 2011, when a group of 120 older men and women were split into two groups, one assigned to a walking program and the other to a stretching regimen, the walkers won over the stretchers. They were the ones who showed larger hippocampi after a year and higher levels of BDNF in their bloodstreams. The stretchers, on the other hand, lost brain volume to normal atrophy and didn't perform as well on cognitive tests. Take a look at the results on the chart in the accompanying PDF. Whatever the activity, we have enough proof to confidently say that exercise needn't be exhausting to be effective for the brain. Grow new networks. Exercise has been proven to induce growth of new neurons in the brain, but the real miracle is that it also has been shown to help build novel networks in the brain. It's one thing to give birth to brain cells, but another to organize those cells into a network that functions in harmony. We don't get smarter just by making new brain cells. We have to be able to interconnect those cells into the existing neural network, Otherwise, they will roam around aimlessly and eventually die. One way to do this is to learn something new. In a 2007 study, newborn neurons in mice became integrated into the animal's brain networks if the mice learned to navigate a water maze. This is a task that requires more cognitive power than physical ability. The researchers also noted that the newbie cells were limited in what they could do. They couldn't, for example, help the mice perform other cognitive tasks beyond the maze. To do that, the mice would need to exert themselves physically, which would encourage those new cells to become spry and cognitively limber. And therein lies the secret benefit of exercise. It makes neurons nimble and able to multitask. We don't know how exercise facilitates mental makeovers on a molecular level, but we do know that BDNF plays a role by strengthening cells and axons, fortifying the connections among neurons, and sparking neurogenesis. Neurogenesis increases the brain's ability to learn new things, which in turn strengthens those new brain cells and further fortifies the neural network. Remember, too, that higher levels of BDNF are associated with a decrease in appetite. So for those individuals who have trouble controlling their appetite, this provides yet another impetus to exercise. With an understanding of the relationship of BDNF to exercise, researchers have been examining the effect of physical exercise in people at risk for or already suffering from brain disorder and disease. In a recent report in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Professor Nicola Lautenschlager of the University of Western Australia found that elderly individuals engaged in regular physical exercise for a 24-week period had an 1,800% improvement on measures of memory, language ability, attention, and other important cognitive functions compared to a control group. The exercise group spent about 142 minutes in physical activity weekly, which averages about 20 minutes a day. The researchers attributed these improvements to better blood flow, the growth of new blood vessels, growth of new brain cells, and improved brain plasticity. In a similar study, Harvard researchers identified a strong association between exercise and cognitive function in elderly women, concluding, "In this large prospective study of older women, higher levels of long-term regular physical activity were strongly associated with higher levels of cognitive function and less cognitive decline. Specifically, the apparent cognitive benefits of greater physical activity were similar to being about 3 years younger in age and associated with a 20% lower risk of cognitive impairment." Multiple effects coalesce when the body is engaged in physical activity. Exercise is a potent anti-inflammatory. By activating the NRF2 pathway I described earlier, physical exercise turns on the genes that suppress inflammation. And this can be measured in the laboratory. Scientists have documented time and time again that C-reactive protein, a commonly used laboratory marker of inflammation, is lower among people who keep an exercise routine. Exercise also improves insulin sensitivity. It helps manage blood sugar balance and reduce the glycation of proteins. We know this to be true from studies done on the effects of exercise on hemoglobin A1c. In one notable study, researchers told 30 participants to make no lifestyle changes while putting 35 others on an exercise program 3 days a week. The control group did not participate in any form of exercise. After the 16th week, hemoglobin A1c decreased by 0.73 in the exercise group, but increased by 0.28 in the non-exercise group. To put these numbers in context, if your hemoglobin A1c was 6.0, a reduction of 0.73 brought on by exercise represents a 12% reduction of hemoglobin A1c, and this rivals diabetes medications. It doesn't take much to make an impact. Okay, So exercise does a body and brain good. But how much? How rigorous? Do household chores and customary daily activities like gardening and taking out the trash count? To answer this, let's turn to a study from Rush University's Memory and Aging Project. When Dr. Aaron S. Buckman examined the effects of daily physical exercise on one's risk for Alzheimer's disease, he found dramatic differences between relatively sedentary people and those performing various types of activities, including simple acts like cooking, washing the dishes, playing cards, pushing a wheelchair, and cleaning. He managed to track people's activity levels using a novel device called an actigraph, which is worn on the wrist to detect and quantify movement. The average age of the individuals who did not have dementia was 82 years. Of the original 716, 71 participants developed full-blown Alzheimer's disease over the course of approximately 3.5 years of follow-up. The results of the study revealed that those individuals in the lowest 10% of daily physical activity had a 230% increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease compared to those in the highest 10% of physical activity. When the data was evaluated in terms of intensity of physical activity, the results were even more compelling. Comparing the people in the bottom 10% of intensity of physical activity to the individuals in the top 10%, Dr. Buckman and his team found that the risk of Alzheimer's was nearly tripled in those who exerted themselves the least. Dr. Buckman rightfully articulated in his conclusions that we cannot underestimate the power of low-cost, easily accessible, and side-effect-free activities that may not entail formal exercise. The mere actions of daily living can provide brain-protective benefits at any age. Pick a play. Clearly, you don't need to set your sights on climbing Mount Everest, nor do you need to train for an endurance event, but regular exercise that gets your heart pumping is a must. Although a small number of studies have found cognitive benefits among older people who just lifted weights for a year, most studies to date, and all animal experiments, have involved running or other aerobic activities such as swimming, bicycling, hiking, and brisk walking at least 5 days a week for at least 20 minutes per session. I realize that exercise is not on most people's list of top priorities, but I hope the evidence I've provided in this chapter will encourage you to rethink your to-dos if you don't already maintain an exercise routine. I'll ask that you devote 1 week during the program to focus on this important area of your life and commence a regular workout if you don't already have one. And if you do, then you can use the week to increase the duration and intensity of your workouts, or try something new. Chapter 9. Good night, brain. Leverage your leptin to rule your hormonal kingdom. Finish each day before you begin the next, and interpose a solid wall of sleep between the two. Ralph Waldo Emerson. When Samuel, a 48-year-old stockbroker, came to see me on a late November day, he asked me to optimize his health. This wasn't the first time someone had made such a blanket, somewhat vague request, but I knew what he really wanted. He wanted me to get to the bottom of his misery and deliver him to a place of vibrant health like he'd never felt before. A tall order for any doctor to fill, but something in his bloated face instantly clued me into what could have been the problem. I started by getting to know his medical history and chief complaints. He had a history of low thyroid function, for which he was taking medication. He said his life was quite stressful, but rated his overall health as good. There wasn't much to report as far as past medical problems, but interestingly enough, he mentioned that his son had been sensitive to solid foods during his infancy and was diagnosed as having gluten sensitivity. We discussed his thyroid issue further, and it turned out that he had an autoimmune disease called Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which is caused by abnormal activation of the immune system that causes it to attack the thyroid gland. I went ahead and ordered a gluten sensitivity test, which produced compelling results. He was indeed highly sensitive to gluten. Only one of the 24 antibodies tested was in the normal range. He desperately needed to try a gluten-free diet. His response to the diet was quite remarkable, and frankly, somewhat predictable in light of both his son's experience and his off-the-charts test. 4 months after he started the diet, I received a letter from him that made me smile. He admitted in writing just how bad his life had gotten by the time he made his appointment to come see me. Evidently, he'd fibbed when he told me that his health was good. It was far from that. He wrote, "Prior to diagnosing me as gluten sensitive, my health was in a downward spiral. Even though I was in my early 40s and worked out daily, I was lethargic and struggled to make it through the day. I was becoming more moody and would easily snap at the smallest things. Depression set in as I couldn't shake negative thoughts. I was convinced that I was dying. Today, I am a new person. I am once again happy-go-lucky, and I have energy throughout the day. I'm sleeping through the night regularly, and my joint pain is gone. I'm able to think clearly and not get sidetracked on my tasks. The best part is that the stubborn fat around my midsection virtually melted off in 2 weeks. I thank you for helping me get my life back." Even though Samuel didn't mention his sleep problems when I first examined him, I had a hunch that restful sleep had evaded him for some time. He looked exhausted and had all the trademark signs of long-term, unfathomable sleep deprivation. For many of my patients prior to being treated, lack of sleep is so normal to them that they forget what it's like to have a good night's sleep until they experience it again. Samuel may have thought that sleeping through the night was just a side benefit to the relief he found from going gluten-free. But it was more than that. The moment Samuel began to have refreshing sleep night after night was the moment he began to deeply replumb his body, hormonally, emotionally, physically, and even spiritually. Casting aside all of his issues with gluten and even his thyroid disorder, I can say without a doubt that achieving regular, restful sleep played a huge role in reversing his conditions and bringing him to exactly where he wanted to be. A place of optimal health. Most of us undervalue the benefits of sleep, but it's one of the few assets in our lives that's totally free and absolutely essential to well-being. It's also, as you're about to find out, a fundamental tool in preventing brain decay. The science of slumber. Much has been written in the last 10 years about the science of sleep, and for good reason. We understand the value of sleep from a scientific perspective as we never have before. Both laboratory and clinical studies have shown that virtually every system in the body is affected by the quality and amount of sleep we get, especially the brain. Among the proven benefits, sleep can dictate how much we eat, how fast our metabolism runs, how fat or thin we get, whether we can fight off infections, how creative and insightful we can be, how well we can cope with stress, how quickly we can process information and learn new things, and how well we can organize and store memories. Adequate sleep, which for the vast majority of us means at least 7 solid hours, also influences our genes. In early 2013, scientists in England found that a week of sleep deprivation altered the function of 711 genes, including some involved in stress, inflammation, immunity, and metabolism. Anything that negatively affects these important functions in the body impacts the brain. We depend on those genes to produce a constant supply of proteins for replacing or repairing damaged tissue, and if they stop working after just a week of poor sleep, that says a lot about the power of sleep. Although we may not notice the side effects of poor sleep on a genetic level, we can certainly experience the other signs of chronic sleep deprivation: confusion, memory loss, brain fog, low immunity, obesity, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and depression. All of these conditions are uniquely tied to the brain. We've also recently come to understand that few of us get enough sleep to support our body's true needs. About 10% of Americans suffer from chronic insomnia, while fully 25% of us report not getting enough sleep at least on occasion. And beyond getting enough sleep, experts are now focused on the quality of sleep in terms of its ability to restore the brain. Is it better to sleep solidly for 6 hours or terribly for 8? One would think that questions like that are easy to answer, and that we'd know everything there is to know about something all of us do for a large portion of our lives. But science is still trying to unravel the mystery of sleep and even how it affects men and women differently. Just as I was writing this chapter, a new study emerged about sleep's surprising effects on hunger. Apparently, the hormones influenced by sleep deprivation are different for men and women. Although the outcome is the same for both sexes, an inclination to overeat, the underlying spark for that hunger is not the same for both sexes. In men, lack of sufficient sleep leads to elevated levels of ghrelin, a hormone that stimulates appetite. In women, on the other hand, ghrelin levels aren't influenced by lack of sleep, but levels of GLP-1, an appetite-suppressing hormone, are. Granted, such a subtle difference may seem insignificant since the overall result of eating more occurred either way, but it goes to show how little we know about the entire biochemistry of the human body in response to sleep. If there's one thing we do know about sleep, it's that it increasingly becomes a challenge the older we get. This is true for a variety of reasons, many of them stemming from medical conditions that can put a dent in sound sleep. As many as 40% of older adults can't get a good night's sleep due to chronic problems like sleep apnea and insomnia. We even have evidence now for the relationship between disrupted sleep and cognitive decline. Christine Yaffe is a psychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco, who studies people who have a higher risk of developing cognitive impairment and dementia. At her memory disorders clinic, she sees a common thread in patients' complaints: difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep. They report being tired throughout the day and resorting to naps. When Yaffe led a series of studies analyzing more than 1,300 adults older than 75 over a 5-year period, she noted that those with disrupted sleep, such as sleep-disordered breathing or sleep apnea, were more than twice as likely to develop dementia years later. Those who experienced breaks in their natural circadian rhythm or who awoke throughout the night were also at increased risk. Circadian rhythms are at the heart and soul of our well-being. By about 6 weeks old, all of us establish this pattern of repeated activity associated with the cycles of day and night that remains for the rest of our lives. As with sunrises and sunsets, these rhythms repeat roughly every 24 hours. We have many cycles that coincide with the 24-hour solar day, from our sleep-wake cycle to the established patterns in our biological beats, the rise and fall of hormones, the fluctuations in body temperature, and the ebb and flow of certain molecules that feed into our health and wellness. When our rhythm is not in sync with the 24-hour solar day, we can feel ill or tired, which is what happens, for instance, when we travel across time zones and force the body to adapt quickly to a new cycle. I find that most people don't appreciate how much of their body's inherent rhythm is grounded in their sleep habits and controlled by their brain. Our body's natural day-night cycles pretty much dictate everything about us, when you consider that our hormonal secretion patterns are tethered to this cycle. A prime example is our body temperature, which, as a consequence of a dance of certain hormones in the body, rises during the day, takes a little dip in the afternoon, hence that late-day lull, peaks in the evening, then begins to decrease during the night. In the early morning hours, it reaches its nadir just as another pattern begins to peak, as cortisol levels reach their height in the morning and thereafter decrease throughout the day. shift workers who are notorious for keeping irregular sleep patterns due to their job responsibilities live with a higher risk for a host of potentially serious illnesses as a result. Indeed, they don't call it the graveyard shift for nothing. So the next time you're feeling uncharacteristically tired, moody, thirsty, hungry, mentally slow, forgetful, or even alert, aggressive, or horny, you can examine your recent sleep habits to glean insights. Suffice it to say, we require a regular, reliable pattern of wakefulness and refreshing sleep to regulate our hormones. Volumes could be written on the body's hormones, but for purposes of this discussion, and in particular, the link between sleep and brain health, we're going to focus on one of the body's most underrated, unsung hormones, leptin. Because it essentially coordinates our body's inflammatory responses and helps determine whether or not we crave carbs, no conversation about brain health can exclude this important hormone. And it's powerfully impacted by sleep. If you can gain control of this biological master of ceremonies, you can rule your hormonal kingdom for the benefit of your brain and body. The fatter you are, the smaller your brain. The year was 1994. It was a discovery that startled the medical community and forever changed how we view not only the human body and its complex hormonal system, but also sleep and its true value in orchestrating the empire. Just when we thought we had discovered all the hormones and their functions, we found a new hormone that we didn't previously know existed. It's called leptin, and it turns out that this isn't just your average hormone. Like insulin, leptin is a major one that ultimately influences all other hormones and controls virtually all the functions of the hypothalamus in the brain. Your hypothalamus is where your inner dinosaur lives. This ancient structure that predates humans sits in the middle of your head and is responsible for your body's rhythmic activities and a vast array of physiological functions, from hunger to sex. But perhaps this finding came so late because leptin was identified in an unlikely place, fat cells. Earlier, I mentioned how we used to think that fat cells were just holding cells packed with unnecessary calories for a rainy day. But now we know that adipose tissue participates in our physiology as much as other vital organs, thanks to resident hormones like leptin that control whether or not we will end up with bulging bellies and small brains. First, a quick disclaimer. Leptin's function in the body, like most every hormone, is extremely complex. The entire hormonal system, in fact, is extraordinarily intricate. There are untold numbers of interrelationships, and describing them all is beyond the scope of this book. I'm going to keep it simple and reveal only what you need to know to take control of your hormones for the benefit of the brain. Leptin is, at a most basic level, a primitive survival tool. It's uniquely tied to the coordination of our metabolic, hormonal, and behavioral response to starvation. As such, it has a powerful effect on our emotions and behavior. Leptin is a gatekeeper of sorts, and once you have an understanding of this hormone, you'll know how to regulate the rest of your hormonal system, and in doing so, manage your health in unimaginable ways. Although leptin is found in fat cells, that doesn't mean it's bad. In excess, it would indeed lead to problems, notably degenerative diseases and a shorter life. But healthy levels of leptin do the opposite, preventing most diseases of aging and supporting longevity. The more you can increase your sensitivity to this critical hormone, the healthier you will be. By sensitivity, I'm referring to how your body's receptors to this hormone recognize and use leptin to carry out various operations. Nora T. Gedgaudas, an acclaimed nutritional therapist, defines leptin succinctly in her book, Primal Body, Primal Mind. Leptin essentially controls mammalian metabolism. Most people think that is the job of the thyroid, but leptin actually controls the thyroid, which regulates the rate of metabolism. Leptin oversees all energy stores. Leptin decides whether to make us hungry and store more fat or to burn fat. Leptin orchestrates our inflammatory response and can even control sympathetic versus parasympathetic arousal in the nervous system. If any part of your hormonal system is awry, including the adrenals or sex hormones, you will never have a prayer of truly resolving those issues until you have brought your leptin levels under control. Gedgaudas calls leptin the new kid on the block who runs the whole neighborhood, and I couldn't agree with her more. The next time you put down your fork and pull away from the dinner table, you can thank your leptin. When your stomach is full, fat cells release leptin to tell your brain to stop eating. It's your break. And this explains why people with low levels of leptin are prone to overeating. A now seminal study published in 2004 showed how people with a 20% drop in leptin experienced a 24% increase in hunger and appetite, driving them toward calorie-dense, high-carbohydrate foods, especially sweets, salty snacks, and starchy foods. And what caused this leptin plunge? Sleep deprivation. We've learned a lot about our hormones just from sleep studies alone. These, in turn, have informed us about the value of sleep in regulating our hormones. Leptin and insulin have a lot in common, though they tend to antagonize each other. Both are pro-inflammatory molecules. Leptin is an inflammatory cytokine in addition to playing a big part in the body's inflammatory processes. It controls the creation of other inflammatory molecules in your fat tissue throughout your body, and it helps explain why overweight and obese people are susceptible to inflammatory problems, including those that substantially increase risk for brain disorders, mental health problems, and neurodegenerative disease. Both leptin and insulin are the higher-ups in the body's chain of command, so imbalances tend to spiral downward and wreak havoc on virtually every system of the body beyond those directly controlled by these hormones. What's more, leptin and insulin are negatively influenced by similar things, and their biggest transgressors are carbohydrates. The more refined and processed the carbohydrate, the more out of whack healthy levels of leptin and insulin become. Earlier, I explained how continuous carbohydrate abuse on the body's insulin pumping and blood sugar balancing will eventually lead to insulin resistance. The same happens with leptin. When the body is overloaded and overwhelmed by substances that cause continuous surges in leptin, the receptors for leptin start to turn off and you become leptin resistant. They stop hearing leptin's message. Put simply, they surrender the controls, and you're left with a body vulnerable to illness and further dysfunction. So even though leptin is now elevated, it doesn't work. It won't signal to your brain that you're full so you can stop eating. And if you cannot control your appetite, then you're at a much greater risk for weight gain and obesity, which puts you at risk for brain disorders. Studies have also shown that elevated triglyceride levels, also a hallmark of too many carbs in the diet, cause leptin resistance. Not a single drug or supplement on the planet can balance leptin levels. But better sleep, as well as better dietary choices, will do the trick. Are you leptin resistant? It's a question we all have to ask ourselves. Unfortunately, millions of Americans qualify as bona fide members of the leptin-resistant club. It's practically a given if you've been eating a high-carb diet and don't sleep well. In Ron Rosedale and Carol Coleman's The Rosedale Diet, a book that takes a sweeping look at leptin in weight control, they enumerate the signs, many of which are common with insulin resistance too. Being overweight. Being unable to change how your body looks, no matter how much you exercise. Being unable to lose weight or keep weight off. Constantly craving comfort foods. Fatigue after meals. Feeling consistently anxious or stressed out. Feeling hungry all the time or at odd hours of the night. Having a tendency to snack after meals. Having high fasting triglycerides, over 100 milligrams per deciliter, particularly when equal to or exceeding cholesterol levels. Having osteoporosis. Having problems falling or staying asleep. High blood pressure. Regularly craving sugar or stimulants like caffeine. The presence of love handles. Don't panic if you have reason to believe you're leptin resistant. The program outlined in Chapter 10 will set you back on track. On the flip side, ghrelin. One more appetite-related hormone I should mention before moving on. Ghrelin. It's the yin to leptin's yang. Ghrelin is secreted by the stomach when it's empty and increases your appetite. It sends a message to your brain that you need to eat. As expected, a disruption in the tango between leptin and ghrelin will wage war on your cravings, sense of fullness, ability to resist temptations in the kitchen, and waistline. In sleep studies, ghrelin levels soared in response to inadequate pillow time in men. This triggered a bigger appetite and a propensity to gravitate toward high-carb, low-nutrient foods that, once consumed, easily get turned into fat. When your appetite hormones are not behaving properly, your brain becomes essentially disconnected from your stomach. It deceives you into thinking you're hungry when you're not, and further stimulates hard-to-resist cravings for foods that will perpetuate that vicious cycle of fat formation. This cycle then feeds the larger feedback loops that play into blood sugar balance, inflammatory pathways, and, of course, risk for brain disorder and disease. Put simply, if you cannot control your hunger and appetite, good luck managing your blood chemistry, metabolism, waistline, and in the bigger picture, the prospect of crippling your brain. During the third week of the program, I'll ask you to focus on achieving high-quality sleep on a routine basis so you can gain control of the hormones that have everything to do with the fate of your brain. And you won't have to reach for a sleep aid. The best sleep for the brain comes naturally. Part 3. Say goodbye to grain brain. Congratulations. You've learned more about the habits of a highly effective brain than most practicing doctors today. If you haven't already begun to change a few things in your life based on what you've heard, now is your chance. In this section of the book, you'll follow a 4-week program, during which you'll shift your diet from relying on carbs and rehabilitate your body back to optimal health. This will be the place where you feel vibrant, energetic, and mentally sharp. It's also where any doctor who examines your blood work will applaud you for having excellent control of your blood sugar, inflammatory markers, and even cholesterol level. It's the place we all dream of being, and it's much closer than you think. Making lifestyle changes, even small ones, can seem overwhelming at first. You wonder how you can avoid your usual habits. Will you feel deprived and hungry? Will you find it impossible to keep this new lifestyle up forever? Is this program doable given the time you have and the commitments you've already made? And can you reach a point where following these guidelines is second nature? This program is the answer. It's a simple, straightforward strategy that has the right balance of structure and adaptability to honor your personal preferences and power of choice. You will finish my 4-week program with the knowledge and inspiration to stay on a healthy path for the rest of your life. The closer you stick to my guidelines, the faster you will see results. Bear in mind that this program has many benefits beyond the obvious physical ones. Optimal brain health and a smaller waistline might be first and foremost on your mind, but the rewards don't end there. You will see change in every area of your life. You will feel more confident and have more self-esteem. You'll feel younger and more in control of your life and future. You'll be able to navigate through stressful times with ease, have the motivation to stay active and engage with others, and feel more accomplished at work and home. In short, you will be happier and more productive, and your success will breed more success. When your life becomes richer, fuller, and more energized as a result of your efforts, you won't want to revert to your old, unhealthy lifestyle. I know you can do this. You must, for yourself and your loved ones. The payoffs, and the potentially calamitous consequences if you don't heed this advice, are huge. Chapter 10. A New Way of Life. The 4-Week Plan of Action. At home, I serve the kind of food I know the story behind. Michael Pollan. Here's where the rubber meets the road. Some of you might be panicking at the thought of losing your beloved carbs. I realize that for some people, ditching bread, pasta, pastries, and most desserts, among other things, is going to be tough. Change is hard, and changing long-established habits is harder. I am often asked right off the bat, what the heck am I going to eat? Some worry about their withdrawal from sugar and wheat and insatiable hunger for carbs. They anticipate colossal cravings that they won't be able to resist. They fear the body's reaction to a dietary U-turn, and they wonder if this is truly doable in the real world if willpower isn't in their vocabulary. Well, folks, let me be the first to say that yes, all of this is possible. You just need to take the initial plunge and experience the effects. Within a matter of days or just a couple of weeks, I predict that you'll have clearer thoughts, better sleep, and improved energy. You'll suffer fewer headaches, manage stress effortlessly, and feel happier. Those of you who live with a chronic neurological condition, such as ADHD, anxiety disorder, or depression, may notice that your symptoms begin to wane or even vanish. Over time, you'll watch the weight fall off, and specific laboratory tests will show vast improvements in many areas of your biochemistry. If you could peer into your brain, you'd also see that it's functioning at its highest level. It's a good idea to check with your doctor about beginning this new program, especially if you have any health issues such as diabetes. This is important if you're going to opt for the one-day fast. Over the course of the next month, you will achieve 4 important goals. 1. Shift your body away from relying on carbs for fuel and add brain-boosting supplements to your daily regimen. 2. Incorporate a fitness routine into your schedule if you don't already have one. 3. Work on getting restful, routine sleep 7 days a week. 4. Establish a new rhythm and maintain healthy habits for life. I've broken down the program into 4 weeks, with each week devoted to focusing on one of these specific goals. In the days leading up to the first week, you should see your doctor to have certain tests performed that will give you a baseline. You'll also use this time to get your kitchen organized, start your supplements, begin to wean yourself from carbs, and consider a one-day fast to kickstart the program. During week 1, focus on food. You'll start my menu plans and execute my dietary recommendations. During week 2, focus on exercise, I'll encourage you to start a regular workout program and give you ideas for moving more throughout the day. In week 3, focus on sleep, you'll turn your attention to your sleep habits and follow a few simple tips to ensure that you're achieving the best sleep possible every single night, weekends included. During week 4, put it all together. I'll help you put all the elements of this program together and equip you with strategies for permanently establishing these new behaviors in your life. Don't second-guess your ability to succeed at this. I've designed this program to be as practical and easy to follow as possible. Prelude to week 1. Prepare. Determine your baseline. Prior to beginning the dietary program, have the following laboratory studies performed if possible. I've included target healthy levels. Fasting blood glucose, less than 95 milligrams per deciliter. Fasting insulin, below 8 microunits per milliliter, ideally below 3. Hemoglobin A1c, 4.8 to 5.4%.